Hello, this is Mary Mortland reading the News Gazette Part 2 for Thursday, January 7th, 2021. We'll begin with some obituaries. James Bish, 84, died at 9:13 a.m. Friday, December 25th at home. Visitation of the Army veteran will be from 11 a.m. to noon Friday at Renner Wyckoff Chapel, 1900 Philo Road, Urbana. All guests are required to wear a face mask. Thank you. Tristan Tantalus Elias Brannon, 23, of Weldon, tragically passed away at 11:38 p.m. Wednesday, December 30th, due to a drunk driver. Due to COVID-19 restrictions, memorial services will be held at a later date. Renner Wyckoff Chapel, 1900 South Philo Road, Urbana, is assisting the family with arrangements. Kathy Bright, 66, of Urbana, died at 9 a.m. Wednesday, December 30th at home. Online memorial services will be at 5 p.m. Thursday on Zoom because of COVID-19 precautions. Renner Wyckoff Chapel and Crematory, 1900 South Philo Road, Urbana, is in charge of arrangements. Larry Carter, 71, died at noon Wednesday, January 6th at Garden View Manor, Danville. Funeral arrangements were incomplete at Robison Chapel, 103 Douglas Street, Catlin. Carla June Henderson, 66, of Philo, passed away Thursday, December 31st at Barnes Jewish Hospital, St. Louis. Visitation will be Friday, January 8th from 4 to 7 p.m. Because of COVID-19 virus protection, the visitation are limited to the number of visitors allowed at a time in the funeral home and will be assisted by the funeral home staff. We appreciate your courtesy for this understanding. Graveside services will be Saturday, January 9th at 12:30 p.m. at Locust Grove Cemetery, Philo. The Reverend Kathy Murphy will officiate. Memorials may be made to the Kentucky Mutts Animal Rescue Nonprofit Organization. Tina Marie Hubbard, 55, of Villa Grove, passed away. 55 of Villa Grove passed away at 6:15 a.m. Tuesday, January 5th at Carl Foundation Hospital. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations may be made to the Villa Grove Booster Club. Kim L. Kiefer, 63, of Champaign, passed away at home from complications from COVID on Tuesday, December 29th. Kim wished to be cremated and sent back to the earth at one of her favorite family camping places. A memorial is yet to be determined, but will likely follow in May 2021. To be added to the guest list, please email Kim's daughter, Shonda, at skiefer13@gmail.com. Catherine Traveglini died at 5:20 a.m. Wednesday, January 6th. Funeral arrangements were incomplete at Walker Funeral Service and Chapel, 704 North 4th Street, Champaign. Joseph A.H. Vasilio, 88, of Westville, died at 1:38 p.m. Sunday, January 3rd at home. Funeral arrangements were incomplete at Rort Vet Funeral Services, 3 South Hodge Street, Clinton. Janet K. Wombles, 58, of Homer, passed away at 10:45 a.m. Monday, January 4th at Carl Foundation Hospital, Urbana. Graveside services will be held Friday, January 8th at Bethel Cemetery, Danville, following a visitation from 1 to 2 p.m. at Kirby Funeral Home, 708 South Main Street, Homer. Pastor C.W. Greer will officiate. Due to COVID-19 restrictions, there will only be 10 people allowed in the funeral home at a time, and everyone is required to wear a mask. Woman gets probation for breaking window. An Urbana woman who admitted she took part in damaging property during riots in Champaign last spring in response to the death of George Floyd in Minnesota has been sentenced to second chance probation. If Savannah K. Jones, 21, of the 1600 block of Cottage Grove Avenue, successfully completes 2 years of probation and 30 hours of public service, then she will have no record of a criminal conviction. Jones pleaded guilty Tuesday before Judge Randy Rosenbaum to criminal damage to property over $500. She admitted that on May 31st, she assisted another woman in breaking a window at the Slumberland Furniture, 615 West Town Center Boulevard, Champaign. Assistant State's Attorney Tom Booker said an employee saw two women get out of a van and throw a C-clamp at the window, breaking it before taking off. The clamp was found near the broken window. The woman was identified later when the van they were in was spotted elsewhere. Jones was interviewed in August about her activity and admitted that she joined Rachel Lang, 20, of Champaign, in damaging Slumberland with the C-clamp. Jones told Champaign police she also threw rocks at the business. Lang's criminal damage case remains unresolved. Jones was also ordered to pay restitution for the damage. Suspects sought in three fires on the same day in Penfield. Crime Stoppers of Champaign County needs help finding the persons or people set fires at the same morning last month in Penfield. About 2:35 a.m. December 20th, sheriff's deputies were called to Main Street, where they learned that three separate fires had been set. One was set in a residential garage and fully engulfed the structure, which contained the resident's vehicle, snowblower, kayaks, and other tools. The second fire was in a trash bin behind a community building owned by a local church. The third was set in a trash barrel inside of the U.S. Post Office, causing minor damage to the inside of the building. If you have any information, contact Crime Stoppers at 217-373-9477 or 373tips.com or via the free P3 Tips mobile app. Tipsters are always 100% completely anonymous when contacting Crime Stoppers. All tips are electronically stripped of any personally identifying information and processed by a third-party answering service. Tipsters will never be asked their name and are given a secret code number to use when checking on a possible reward. Cash rewards of up to $1,000 may be paid on tips that lead to an arrest. We have Jim Dye's opinion column. Notorious kidnapping case remains in court. Though Kankakee businesswoman William Small's life was tragically cut short in 1987, the legal cases that have sprung out of his grisly death seem to live forever. 33 years after she was convicted of helping her boyfriend kidnap and bury Small alive, 59-year-old Nancy Risch continues her legal efforts attacking her conviction and life sentence. Last month, the Third District Appellate Court in Ottawa heard oral arguments in another appeal in this highly publicized case. Having run the gamut of legal issues over the past three decades, Risch's lawyers now argue she is entitled to a new sentencing hearing and a reduced sentence because Danny Edwards, her boyfriend and convicted accomplice, subjected her to physical abuse that compelled her to unwittingly participate in his plot to extort $1 million from the Small family. A relentless litigator, her latest appeal argued that she is undeserving of the life sentence because Edwards' abuse compelled her participation in the crime stems from a 2015 law. It requires judges to consider evidence of physical abuse as a mitigating factor when handing down a sentence. Edwards, who turned 63 on Sunday, was initially sentenced to death. That was commuted to life in prison by former Governor George Ryan. He's being held at the Pontiac Correctional Center. Risch, his one-time girlfriend, who is described as a problem-free inmate, is being held at the Logan Correctional Center. She's proved to be a relentless litigator, filing a series of state and federal appeals in which she has alternatively argued that prosecutors failed to prove her guilty beyond a reasonable doubt and that she is actually innocent because she unwittingly aided Edwards. Characterizing her sentence as unduly harsh, Risch also sought a clemency grant from the governor. But Risch's credibility has been seriously challenged since she first came under suspicion in the case. In different interviews with investigators, she told a series of conflicting stories designed to evade legal accountability for Small's kidnapping and death. In a previous ruling in the case, the appellate court found that Risch's various versions about what she knew or didn't know and what she and Edwards did during the early days of September 1987 damaged her credibility, and jurors could probably conclude that Risch's after-the-fact behavior amounted to an attempt to conceal the truth. In attempting to win a new sentencing hearing, Risch's lawyers have dragged Attorney General Kwame Raoul into the legal discussion. They note that when Raoul was a state legislator, he sponsored legislation that categorized physical abuse as a mitigating factor. They have characterized him as a hypocrite for his office's opposition to Risch's petition. The law, however, does not require a judge to grant a lesser sentence in the face of an abuse claim. It merely permits that factor to be considered in the context of all the facts of the case. Even if abuse is present, it may be legally insufficient to justify a lesser sentence if other facts in the case are severe. Citing both the facts of the case and what they contend is a lack of credible evidence of severe abuse, prosecutors said Risch is not entitled to a new sentencing hearing. That's prompted Risch's lawyers to complain bitterly of the state's reliance on the awful facts in this case to tar their client. Raoul's office has been used to bludgeoning Mrs. Risch over the head for the last 30 years with the gruesome details of Denny Edwards' crime, they complain. Prosecutors, however, respond that Risch's claims to have unknowingly assisted Edwards in the kidnapping plot already have been considered and rejected by the courts. They contend that for her now to argue that she assisted him because he threatened and abused her is an inconsistency the courts ought to reject. Painting the picture. Evidence in this case showed that Edwards pretended to be a police officer, phoned Small, and lured him to a house. Small was renovating by telling him it had been vandalized. After kidnapping Small, he put him in a box he had built in Risch's garage and buried him alive. Before being buried, Small called his wife to tell her of his kidnapping and asked her to come up with $1 million. After being put in the ground, Small quickly suffocated. Police came up with Edwards and Risch as suspects when they staked out a telephone booth where Edwards called the Small residence. They spotted Risch driving Edwards to various locales and eventually brought the couple in for an interview. After questioning Edwards, led authorities to the Small burial site. In addition to Edwards' confession, authorities presented witnesses who described Edwards' visits to local stores where he bought materials he used in the kidnapping. The witnesses said he was accompanied by a blonde woman, ultimately identified as Risch. Coronavirus pandemic, day 299. Illinois impact, statewide mask mandate extended. Vermilion, Douglas report deaths, Piatt begins vaccinations. Today is likely the day that Illinois will join California, Texas, Florida, and New York as states with more than 1 million COVID-19 cases. It's just 712 away after adding 7,569 on Wednesday. Amid announcements about mitigation tiers and vaccine ages was Wednesday's news that Illinois extended its statewide mask mandate, which remained in effect for 150 days. The previous mandate expired Sunday. A man in his 40s became the 80th Vermilion County resident to lose their life to COVID-19, health officials announced. Douglas County reported its 33rd death of the pandemic, a man in his 80s. At the Danville Correctional Center, site of the state's second-largest ongoing prison outbreak, active cases among inmates rose by 12 to 278, while active staff cases fell by 4 to 21. A metric to watch closely between now and January 15th, when qualifying regions will be allowed to move out of their Tier 3 mitigations, hospitalizations. Carl's Urbana Hospital, which serves the broad region, reported 68 COVID-19 patients Wednesday, its most since December 17th. Some 41 COVID-19 positive Vermilion County residents remained hospitalized, also unchanged from the day before, Champaign County's total of 19. The reason for Champaign County's case total only growing by 36 when it added 56 Wednesday, data corrections related to out-of-county residents mistakenly counted in Champaign County's totals, according to the Champaign-Urbana Public Health District. The zip codes with the most active cases of the county's 715. 61821, Champaign, 121. 61822, Champaign, 88. 61853, Mahama, 81. 61866, Rantoul, 79. Doses of the COVID-19 vaccine are being administered this week at Piatt County long-term care facilities, including 39 at Maple Point Supportive Living. Residents there are due to get second shots on January 25th. But vaccinations are on hold at the Piatt County Nursing Home. Director Scott Porter told the Journal Republican Steve Hoffman due to the high number of cases, 42 since early December. And then there's a headline. This is on page D1. Move it quickly. We're serious. Governor scrambled a speed vaccine after slow start. New York's governor threatened to fine hospitals if they don't use their allotment of COVID-19 vaccine fast enough. His South Carolina counterpart warned healthcare workers they have until January 15th to get a shot or move to the back of the line. California's governor wants to use dentists to vaccinate people. With frustration rising over the sluggish rollout of the vaccine, state leaders and other politicians around the U.S. are turning up the pressure, improvising and seeking to bend the rules to get shots in arms more quickly. Meanwhile, U.S. Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar said Wednesday that the government will allow more drugstores to start giving vaccinations to speed up the process. If health workers aren't lining up fast enough, he said, it is okay to expand eligibility to lower priority groups. We need to not be overly prescriptive in that, especially as we see governors who are leaving vaccines sitting in freezers rather than getting them into people's arms, he said. As of Wednesday, more than 3 weeks into the U.S. vaccination campaign, 5.3 million people had gotten their first shot out of the 17 million doses distributed so far, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. While it is believed to an undercount, because of a lag in reporting, health officials are still well behind where they wanted to be. The slow rollout has been blamed on a multitude of problems, including a lack of funding and direction from Washington, mismatches between supply and demand, a patchwork of approaches by state and local governments, distrust of the vaccine, and disarray created by the holidays. Across much of the nation, healthcare workers and nursing home residents are being given priorities for the initial limited supplies of the vaccine at this stage, but pressure is building to let other groups step up. Louisiana began vaccinating older people Monday, while Alaska and Mississippi have given the go-okay for the elderly to start receiving shots over the next few days. The U.S. has an estimated 21 million healthcare workers and 3 million residents of nursing homes and other long-term care centers. The CDC has about 512,000 people in such centers have been vaccinated through a partnership between the government and the CVS and Walgreens drugstore chains. Government officials over the past few days reported that the number of people receiving shots has accelerated to about 500,000 a day, and Dr. Anthony Fauci, the nation's top infectious disease expert, said the pace could soon reach 1 million or more. Fauci estimated that between 70 and 85% of the U.S. population will ultimately need to be vaccinated to achieve herd immunity, a goal he said would be achieved by the start of the next fall. That translates to as many as 280 million people. Azar announced that in addition to the nursing home program, pharmacies from 19 chains will be allowed to help now with dispensing shots to ease pressure on hospitals, which have been the main vaccine providers so far. More than 40,000 drugstores will eventually be involved, he said. The pharmacies will still have to follow state guidelines for who gets in line first. The U.S. death toll, meanwhile, climbs up to around 360,000. COVID-19 deaths set another one-day record at 3,775 on Tuesday, though authorities have cautioned that the numbers around holidays can fluctuate dramatically because some health agencies fall behind in reported cases, then catch up. Concerns also grew about a new, more contagious variant of the virus. In Southern California, San Diego County health officials confirmed 24 cases, the biggest known concentration so far in the United States. Cases have also been reported in Colorado, Florida, Georgia, and New York. With cases and hospitalizations also soaring, politicians are getting aggressive in trying to accelerate the vaccination drive. The governors of California, Maryland, and North Carolina said they will use the National Guard. Maryland Governor Larry Hogan warned, too, that any facility that has not administered at least 75% of its first doses may have future allocations reduced until they can speed up vaccinations. While about 270,000 doses have been put directly in the hands of frontline vaccinators in the state over the last 3 weeks, Hogan said that only about 77,000 people have been inoculated as of Tuesday, or about 1.3% of the state's populations. Governor Henry McMaster of South Carolina warned that health care workers will lose their places in line if they don't move quickly to get their shots. As of Monday, the state has given out less than half its initial allotment of the Pfizer vaccine to about 43,000 people. In California, where just 1% of the population was reported vaccinated, Governor Gavin Newsom said he wants to give providers the flexibility to give shots to people not on the priority list if doses are in danger of going to waste. He also wants to expand the pool of professionals dispensing shots. The pace had been so slow in New York that Governor Andrew Cuomo on Monday threatened to fine hospitals up to $100,000 if they don't finish their round of inoculations by the end of the week. He also threatened to stop sending the vaccine to hospitals that don't use their share promptly. "Move it quickly. We're serious," Cuomo warned. "If you don't want to be fined, just don't participate in the program. It's not a mandatory program." The delays prompted by New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio to call for eligibility to be expanded, and on Wednesday he announced a plan to provide shots to 10,000 of the city's police officers by Sunday. But Cuomo immediately shot down that idea, saying we need to get the health care population done first because they are the front line. Ask the Admin, a daily question for the Champaign-Urbana Public Health District's Julie Pride. According to the Illinois Department of Public Health's website, our region, Region 6, has met all four criteria for moving out of Tier 3 COVID-19 mitigation measures. Why has the state not moved us to Tier 2? Do the metrics the state has advanced mean anything, or are they completely arbitrary? Answer: the governor's office and state health department were waiting to get past the holidays. It was likely that many communities would see a spike like they did after Thanksgiving. Rantoul City Schools to begin testing staff and students. Rantoul City School Superintendent Michelle Ramage said her district will begin rapid antigen testing for the coronavirus for staff and students when in-person learning resumes January 19th. She said the district's situation might be different from some others because of its doctor's standing order that won't allow for weekly staff testing as the district had originally planned. "The test was not initially designed for that purpose. If we test asymptomatic individuals, it could lead to a false positive result," she said. "In this situation, no symptoms. The individual is quarantined until the results of a PCR test are available. Therefore, our doctor said we could end up with more individuals quarantined unnecessarily until the PCR test result is given." She said the test is much more accurate for symptomatic individuals. "It will be voluntary and written permission is needed," she said. "The district might start testing some staff next week to ease into it." "We do have some staff on campus that may be interested," Ramage said. Rantoul City Schools is one of the 40 districts in Illinois selected to receive the rapid antigen testing kits. "We are very concerned there is very little testing available in Rantoul," Ramage said. "This is only available to RCS students and staff. We are developing communications at this time to send to parents next week." Ramage said the district received assistance from the Champaign-Urbana Public Health District and Illinois State Board of Education. District nurses have been making preparations, getting trained, and taking on this additional responsibility. And we have some sports news, beginning with Illinois men's basketball. Illini adapting to different methods. Illinois ran Minnesota off the court in its Big Ten opener in mid-December, a 92-65 victory that wasn't even as close as that 27-point margin. The next game was a high-scoring shootout in a 91-88 loss at Rutgers, then another in a 98-81 win at Penn State. Those games raised a basic question. What had happened to the grit and grind Big Ten? The answer came during the past two weekends. Indiana was more than happy to slow the game down. Purdue even more so, as one of the slowest teams in the country, doubling down on that with a pair of big men more than Oklahoma, with slugging it out more than okay with slugging it out in the paint. Illinois won both. Not with a high-octane offense that averaged 89.3 points in the first nine games. Not always with the prettiest basketball, either. But finding a way, anyway, to win. A big deal in the Big Ten, where the challenges just kept coming, like an 8 p.m. Thursday tip in Evanston for number 12 Illinois, 8-3, 4-1 in the Big Ten, against just outside the top 25 Northwestern, 6-3, 2-2. Every game, you're not going to score 100 points or 90, Illinois junior guard Io DeSumo said. It's not just going to be all free-flowing, easy games. There's going to be games like Purdue and Indiana where you have teams who are well-coached and they make it a rugged, physical game. You've got to be able to find other ways to win. Illinois was held in its lowest point total of the season in its 66-58 win against Purdue this past Saturday. The Boilermakers flipped the game at the end of the first half and into the second with a 19-0 run. Even with a 9 of 22 showing at the free throw line, the Illini rallied and won. In the Big Ten, you really don't look at the outcome of the score, DeSumo said. You look at wins and losses. Always when you get a win, that's a blessing. We're excited and looking forward to getting another win in Chicago Thursday. Adaptation is key. Good teams do it and win. Illinois has shown it can win a game running and win a game grinding. Illini coach Brad Underwood has ties both to his team's scouting report work before a game and its defense and rebounding during it. You prepare for the 2 days leading up, Underwood said. You get a mind frame of what that game is going to be about. You know when you play a certain team, it's going to be high tempo, fast paced, a little bit looser. You know when you get the big boy from Purdue checking in the game that you're going to cram it down your throat for him. You've got to be able to adapt. You've got to be able to win different ways, whether it's scoring 90 or whether it's scoring 60. Illinois' preference is to push the tempo. DeSumo and Andre Corbello give the Illini transition offense a real one-man fast break vibe. That the Illinois bigs run the floor well makes the team even tougher to slow down. Some games, though, don't lend themselves to a quicker pace, like the last two. Indiana finished at 69-60, loss to Illinois on December 26th with just 3 offensive rebounds. Purdue pulled down just 6 offensive rebounds a week later. It wasn't for a lack of effort, not exactly. It was more a style choice on the part of coaches Archie Miller and Matt Painter, respectively. Style is something we can try to emphasize, and we do because of our running, Underwood said. Teams have to adjust to that. You look at our last two opponents, and they've set 3 or 4 guys back to try to stop us in transition. We force some things ourselves, but we can't do that at the expense of trying to be really sloppy. Illinois still managed to score 18 points in less than 20 seconds against Purdue. Underwood considered that a pretty good number for the type of game that one wound up being. That paled in comparison, however, to the 34 points scored in less than 20 seconds against Duke and the 33 against Minnesota. Sometimes we can force it, Underwood said. Sometimes we can't. But we've got to be able to settle in and play how we need to play, especially on the defensive side, to sustain winning. This has been Mary Mortland reading the News Gazette Part 2 for Thursday, January 7th, 2021. Please have a safe and warm weekend.